1978. When they'd see him coming down the street, most of the denizens of Newcastle, Pennsylvania would cross to the other side. Sometimes they referred to him as the Witch of Highland Avenue, or the High Priest of Satan, but mostly they called him the Devil Man. He was tall, slovenly, absent most of his teeth, long hair and beard. He sometimes wore a blood-red suit, but normally dressed like if Sons of Anarchy had taken place in the 70s. He looked wild, like everyone's idea of an evil biker, except he didn't have a hog. His disability check, working odd jobs around his apartment complex, and his artwork were his income. It wasn't much, but it kept him in beer, drugs, and occult books, which appeared to be his three favorite things besides young men. And he liked when people crossed the street to avoid him. He liked that they were afraid of him. But the 20-somethings and teenagers of this hardscrabble town, mostly the ones that came from the hard luck homes, they weren't scared of him. They found him and his apartment, which had become sort of a meeting place for the town's underbelly. They found it all fascinating. Frank told them that he could put death curses on people, commune with demons, and was a close personal friend of Church of Satan founder Anton LaVey. Frank Costell was called the Devil Man for a reason. He was an ardent Satanist and practitioner of the occult. Most people who came into contact with him, whether through a friend of a friend or somewhere along the illegal pharmaceutical pipeline which often passed through Frank's apartment, they were usually skeeved out by him and wanted nothing to do with the man. This was the guy who very seriously explained to complete strangers visiting his home that the plastic bats he had adorning one of his lampshades represented his followers, and all he had to do was take one of them off the lampshade, and one of them would die. But quite a few people gravitated towards him. Frank himself wouldn't say he led a cult, but others would. His home had become sort of a meeting place for the town's more gritty castouts, alcoholics, drug addicts, those who were often in trouble with the law and weren't unwelcome in other places in this dead-end town, where unemployment was rampant in 1978, and hence so were the drugs and crime. On Frank's part, he liked an audience for his lectures about Satanism and magic, and for his readings from the books of occultists like Aleister Crowley. He also liked the impressionable teenage boys and lost young men that seemed to gravitate towards him. Frank also had friends and followers who were the other kind of outsider in Newcastle. The cruel ones, violent and abusive. Cruel people liked Frank. After all, wasn't the main tenet of Satanism do what thou wilt? These were the sort of people who would take that as a license to wreak havoc and pain. Frank had more than one friend who was a violent offender. They were not the sort of people you wanted to mingle with. And truly, although Frank could be a hospitable sort, you didn't want to mingle with him either. Most killers, the ones who do it out of desperation for money or drugs anyway, they draw a line when it comes to women and children. Frank and his friends, they didn't. You're listening to Wicked Gay, a true crime podcast about gay people doing awful things. Welcome back. I'm your host, Jay Harvey. Tonight's episode, well, I said tonight, that's weird. Hopefully you're listening at night. This episode is about a rather disturbing man and some of the equally disturbing people in his orbit. It's about an alleged gay affair that might have led to a nightmarish murder. This guy and his life were the furthest thing from brunch I could think of. When I say that, I mean it's a gay story that I hadn't heard before, an unusual one. And it creeped me out, not because it was an unusual one, just because of what happened in the story. I mean, it takes all kinds, as they say. It was a seemingly dead-end town, with a lot of people burying themselves in substances to escape. It was only the year before that the Sex Pistols released God Save the Queen with its infamous refrain of no future. No future. I'm not sure if anyone in the story knew it, heard it, or were even aware of it, but thematically, it fits this episode. I must say, the crimes in this episode are very serious. And one of them involves a child, so fair warning to my listeners here. I'm not going to dwell on the details, but it's something you should be aware of before we proceed. This is episode 9, A Real Strange Asshole, the Frank Costell Story. So it's July 11th, 1978. Rose, 35, her teenage daughter Lori, and Lori's boyfriend, they stop in to call on their friend Kathy Kadunz, 25. Kathy was like another daughter to Rose, and had been Lori's babysitter when she was little. She was like a member of their family, basically. Kathy had only recently given birth to her son, Robert, nicknamed Dino, and Lori wanted to see the baby and Kathy's other child, 4-year-old Dawn. Now, a weird detail in the source material for this about this outing was that they had just come from a gynecologist's office, And because Rose had just had a hysterectomy, which is awful. And two things struck me. One was that she had a hysterectomy, and then what happened next happened. So what a horrible week this had been for her. And two, why would your teenage daughter's boyfriend want to accompany his girlfriend and his girlfriend's mom on this visit? Like, why would you want to go on this? It just seems so awkward and weird. Like, okay, bring your boyfriend along. I'm going to recount the events of getting my uterus taken out. That sounds like fun. What? It just struck me as weird. Anyway, so about Kathy Kadunz, Rose knew that Kathy's marriage wasn't on solid ground, right? A few years earlier, her husband and the father to her two kids, Lawrence Kadunz, known as both Lou and Larry, and I'll probably get Lou and Larry, I'll probably use both names because you know me. So just so you know, Lou and Larry is the husband of this story. He'd done 6 weeks in jail after being busted four times for indecent exposure in a 3-week period. So dude really wanted to show off his schlong. He was supposedly seeking help for this problem. But Kathy had privately confided to Rose that she was afraid that if Lou got busted again, he'd lose his job and she'd probably leave him. The trio arrive at the Kadunz home on Wilmington Road in Newcastle, and they park in the back and they enter through the storm door and a partially open inside door. When they get inside, Rose noticed little Dino was in his crib and he was crying, and she picked him up and noticing he was wet, and she figured that Kathy was doing something upstairs and maybe couldn't hear him over the sound of a radio or something. So she sent Lori upstairs to get her. And a few minutes later, she heard Lori's blood-curdling scream. Many of the cops on the scene later said it was one of the worst crime scenes they had ever encountered. It was very, very bloody, and there had been horrific violence. And 4-year-old Dawn's body was found on the floor of her bedroom. She'd been stabbed 17 times. Her mother Kathy's nude body was in a pool of blood on the bathroom floor. She had also been stabbed 17 times, as well as being shot point-blank in the head. Thankfully, baby Dino was unharmed. Kathy's husband, Lou Kadunz, was summoned from the factory he worked at. His alibi was that he was on his way to work when the murders occurred, which a coroner determined was between 7 and 8:45 a.m. that morning. By the way, the coroner also used the words excessive and overkill when describing the murders in his report. When he described his activities to the cops that morning, he initially said that Kathy had been asleep when he left. But the second time he went over them, he said that she was awake and breastfeeding Dino when he left. So he had two different stories. In both of his accounts, Dawn had been asleep in her bedroom. And the detectives also noted that Lou's lack of emotion, he didn't really register shock or grief or anger when they told him what had happened. He seemed numb. Okay, personal note here. You know how people are always like, if they don't cry and carry on at the crime scene, they're obviously, they did it, you know? Like even police detectives, like when you watch Dateline, they get on. And like the insipid correspondent, the blonde woman, Andrea, is her name Canning? Yeah, she's insipid. And she asks ridiculous questions. And somehow they all ask the same questions to elicit responses from the people. But for some reason, hers sound really condescending and like she's talking to a romper room full of children. She just annoys me. So she'll be like, yeah, and so what was his reaction? And the cops will be like, well, he didn't really show any emotion. And she'd be like, well, what did that say to you then? And he's like, oh, well, obviously he was a suspect because he didn't show any emotion. And I just want to say that even if someone is dry-eyed, like grief works in different ways, right? Who knows how grief is going to present, you know, if you lose somebody, especially in a horrific incident like that, like this, like a murder. It's going to be the shock of a lifetime. And I usually turn to my husband at this point and like complain about this because I know that if something horrible ever happens to me, right, and I don't have the appropriate reaction as determined by the general public and the cops, I'm screwed. I'm a suspect, right? That always irked me. Anyway, digression over. This was kind of a diatribe. Later, Lou was informed that he was the only suspect that they had at the moment, and he lawyered up really quickly. The cops learned of his marital difficulties and his indecent exposure rap sheet. He apparently had a thing for taking out the garbage in the nude repeatedly, and even after he was asked not to by the neighbors. And it wasn't like an, oh, I forgot, I was in my underwear and got locked out type thing. It read more like, aren't I so naughty, and isn't it naughty how you can see my peen, you lusty neighbors, pant pant. The police also learned that Lou, who attended night school, had recently gotten into a heated debate with a psychology lecturer, about his opinion that a wife had no right to criticize her husband about his friends and job. So, Lou sounds like he was definitely marriage material, no argument there. Despite Lou Kadunce being the prime suspect, they didn't have any solid evidence, so the case remained unsolved until January. In January of 1979, they caught a tip that a man named Michael Atkinson, known as Mike, was involved in Kathy and Don's murders. Atkinson, 28, he was a known psycho whose hometown was nearby Elwood City, which was a few miles south of Newcastle. Anyone who came into contact with Mike knew he was bad news. They issued a warrant for his arrest in February, but he was pretty easy to track down, seeing as he was currently being held at the Butler County Sheriff's Office jail on charges that he had murdered his 84-year-old landlady. With only a little bit of pressure from the detectives, he admitted that he'd been at the Kadunce house that morning around 6 a.m., the morning of the murders. He said that he arrived by car with two friends, one named John Duwadic, that could be a mispronunciation, I'm sorry. He's dead anyway, so he probably doesn't care. Also, he might be a murderer, so who cares? The other friend was named Frank Costell, and Mike Atkinson claimed that he had stayed in the car while Frank and John went in. He said that Costell and Duwadic were meeting Lou Kadunce at his house so they could have a word with his wife, Kathy, who had allegedly flushed someone's drugs down a toilet. Cops were very keen on Frank and John after Mike's story, especially Frank, who seemed like a fascinating character the more they heard about him. In truth, he was. The whole Costell family was. The Costells were Newcastle legends, a legend that began with Frank's one-legged grandmother, Beatrice. Beatrice sounded fascinating when I read about her. Beatrice had lost her gam when she stepped out in front of a car in town. It wasn't known whether this was a suicide attempt, a legit accident, or some sort of attention-getting maneuver, because Beatrice was known for her eccentricity. She was the kind of gal who would bring unusual lizards she found to the Newcastle News newspaper office to have them ID'd. I don't know. Maybe there was a lizard rider on staff back then? I have no idea. Unexplained fires broke out at her house all the time. She was a whack job. In 1932, when her grandson Frank Costell was 4 years old, she shot her husband in the back of the head with a 25 caliber revolver and then turned the gun on herself. So Frank's own eccentricity might have had a genetic component. He was born on February 28, 1928. His dad, who hated the way Frank carried himself, beat him regularly with very little provocation. It got so bad that Frank, who knew that he was gay from a very young age, left home at 14, jumping on a flatbed railway car and eventually joining a carnival. And the carny lifestyle would be his for many, many years. He was pretty much raised on the carnival circuit. Barkers, hawkers, con men, clowns, acrobats, freaks, pickpockets, fortune tellers, scam artists, they were the people who raised him, really. And he found that it was okay to be openly gay with these people, and also that's where he discovered devil worship and black magic. Look, I don't care who runs the Tilt-A-Whirl, as long as it passes inspection. But some of the scraggly-looking Satan worshippers manning the rides look untrustworthy, right? At one point or another, and with many different carnivals, Frank did every job possible. His favorite, though, was working in the freak show. For one carnival, he worked in the freak show in half in drag and was playing the, quote, hermaphrodite Frankie/Francine. People were so sensitive back then, weren't they? And he came to view the rest of humanity as prey. People who weren't carnies were prey, just people to con money out of, with a series of like rackets and schemes, whether it was through rigged carnival games or fortune telling. When Frank got older, he eventually left the carnival and settled back. He went back to Pennsylvania and settled down, and he drifted through a series of jobs in mills and factories. Due to a job accident, he went on permanent disability sometime in the 70s at the age of 42. Apparently his string art was good. I guess Frank, he actually had artistic talent, which is, you know, evil people have talent sometimes, right? You've heard of Steve Jobs. He was a huge asshole, and look what he did. And Frank began to spend most of his time with teenage boys from the nearby projects and the various ne'er-do-wells around Newcastle. And he would date 20-something men, many of whom were intellectually challenged. So that's icky. In 1977, he had an affair with a high school dropout ex-con named Paul, whom he chased out of his life with a sword when he discovered Paul was flirting with a woman who had lived across the hall from Frank. They eventually made up, but then Paul went to prison for 2 years for robbing a bait shop. In 1979, he mock-married 19-year-old high school dropout Marshall, Three teenage boys witnessed that ceremony and signed a wedding certificate that Frank designed himself. He considered it to be serious, so post-wedding, when Marshall informed him that he was bisexual with a preference for women, Frank flipped out and once again chased him with the same sword that he had chased Paul with. So the sword thing was a definite Frank Costell trope. And then there was Frank's apartment, which was the stuff of legend in Newcastle. And let me give you a few details on the apartment. It was filled with books on outsider religions, on the occult, black magic, witchcraft, and devil worship. The walls were supposedly covered with floor-to-ceiling black curtains with blood-red curtains on the windows. Hanging from the ceiling and the lampshades were rubber bats and small plastic skeletons. There were skulls everywhere, including one on the mantle that had a bullet in its teeth and a dagger through it. There were inverted crucifixes with skeletons crucified to them. There was a huge portrait of a cross-legged Satan goat with piercing red eyes and breasts that glared at you when you walked in. On another wall was a huge upside-down pentagram was drawn with demonic names flanking that. He also supposedly had a portrait of the Last Supper that had, instead of Jesus and the apostles, had like demons drawn in. So that must have been cute. It reads like it was a wild place and probably would have been a super cool haunted house at Halloween if it wasn't like a for real evil gathering place. And on special nights, Frank would don his satanic robe that also had an upside down pentagram on it, and he'd assemble his ragtag followers, that's in quotes, and he'd perform satanic wedding ceremonies and makeshift satanic masses and seances in which he would read and interpret passages from the Satanic Bible and the Witch's Bible and the writings of Aleister Crowley. They always cite Aleister in these kinds of stories. Do you think Aleister's looking up from hell wherever he went and he's like, cut the shit, leave my stuff alone? Or do you think he's happy that he's constantly referenced by these idiots? During these ceremonies, in which the followers were supposedly rapt with attention, Frank would raise his sword aloft and ring a special bell to summon the forces of darkness. Frank bought his own bullshit, too. He once cursed a taxi driver who reportedly got in a major accident afterwards. He cursed the salad bar employees down at the mall for giving him shit when he used his hands to scoop the salad into his plate, and he could often be found down at Newcastle's library looking for occult books and placing death curses on the librarian when she didn't move fast enough to help him find books. In fact, one of the cops who had to deal with him once referred to him as, quote, a real strange asshole. Pretty accurate so far, and there's the title of this episode. That's where I got it. Frank Costell, real strange asshole. Now, as for the guy who snitched on him, Mike Atkinson, police later found out that Frank and Mike were occasional lovers. Mike was also a bisexual that preferred women, but Frank had a pretty good hookup for drugs, so why not, right? I guess you could overlook the lack of teeth, or maybe that came in handy. Okay, I'm gonna stop right now. Frank Costell was eventually arrested in February of 1980 on suspicion of murder and the deaths of Kathleen and Don Cadunce. During his interrogation, he confessed that he, along with Atkinson, John Dedoche, and Lou Cadunce, the husband, were all at the crime scene that morning. Frank said that he went to the house to deal with Kathleen for flushing a stash of drugs that her husband Lou had brought home. Costell said that he had given the drugs to Lou, who he also claimed was his boyfriend. And later on during his trial, he would deny that he said this, and that he said he had no idea who Lou was. So, I don't know, sounds like bullshit to me. He admitted to being in the house, but claimed that his companions had killed Kathleen because of what she had done, and the little girl had to die so she couldn't identify the killers. You know, and upon reading that reasoning, my general malaise when it comes to humanity was reinforced, because it was a 4-year-old girl. And as for that John guy, he had supposedly committed suicide in November of 1979, and it was said to have been out of guilt for his part in the murders. But then informants came forward later that said Frank had something to do with his death, the Devil Man, so he wouldn't talk about the Cadunce murders. Michael Atkinson went on trial for his involvement in the Cadunce murders in September of 1980, and it should be noted that he was found guilty of the rape of a 17-year-old girl the March before.
He faced first-degree murder charges for Kathleen and third-degree for Don, since that wasn't considered premeditated but instead spur of the moment. And I'm sure that lessened the blow for Kathy and Don's family and friends, right? Interesting note, nowadays, Mike Atkinson could have received the death penalty for the killing of a witness in Pennsylvania. Another creepy detail in this story is that the police suspected Mike, as well as Frank, of being involved in the murder of a 37-year-old babysitter and the child she was babysitting that night, who was four. Police didn't have enough evidence to bring charges, but that's either the worst coincidence ever or really dark-sided pattern on their part. That happened on November 7th, 1975, and it took place in Newcastle, and that murder remains unsolved. So, the Devil Man's trial started on January 5th, 1981. The prosecutor called in every member of Frank's cult that he could find, and he argued that the reason behind the murders, besides revenge against Kathy Kadunce for flushing the drugs, was that Frank wanted Lou Kadunce all to himself, because they were supposedly lovers. And it was every member of his cult, and even people who had been there to witness the goings-on and weren't followers. These people had already told their stories to the cops during the investigation, and the cops knew that they had to tell them at trial. So it was a parade of crazy Frank stories, which I'll get into right now. Testimony was given about the marriage ceremonies that Frank would perform between his followers and for himself and his young lovers. I know we're talking devil worship here, but how are you the groom and the officiant at the same time? Shouldn't you have one of your culties take a course or something so they can officiate? He was probably a control freak too, in addition to the myriad of other unsavory components to his personality. Frank's ex-husband, Marshall, testified that he had married Frank in a satanic wedding ceremony in Frank's satanic kitchen. He said that afterwards he lived with Frank for 2 months until Frank threatened to skewer him with his sword for talking to girls. Well, Frank, maybe those girls had all their teeth. Several of the witnesses testified to Frank's alleged cross-dressing, noting that the high priest was very comfortable with lounging about his hell condo in red panties and stockings. You know, shrug. I've seen pics of this guy. It might not have been the most appetizing of visuals, but everyone's got their something, right? A witness and cult member named George took the stand to swear that Frank could control people by using a voodoo doll in his apartment. He said that Frank would light black candles on the floor. He said that Frank would light black candles on the floor and speak in a strange language to take over someone's soul, to act as his puppet. He also added the lascivious detail that he had seen Frank and Mike Atkinson in their underwear kissing. That apartment was busy. There was a lot going on in that place. Frank later said that during his trial, he would disassociate from the proceedings and use his psychic gift of releasing his astral form to float among the ether, so he wouldn't have to sit around and listen to the details of how he assisted in brutally murdering a mother and a daughter. And it's really nice that he could find that escape, right? As for that astral projection stuff, another witness was a former lover of Frank's and follower named Steve. He was a ninth grade dropout who lived in terror of Frank, even though Frank was currently in jail when he wasn't floating around the courtroom in his astral form. Actually, Frank had warned Steve that he could teleport around and follow Steve wherever he went. Steve said that he was afraid that Frank would one day put one of his patented hoodoo guru curses on him. A man named Ben testified that Constable preached to him that churches were fake and that the Virgin Mary had been a lesbian and her son Jesus a queer, which must have gone over really well with the conservative-sounding jury. I mean, God, just drop the guillotine blade on Frank right there when I heard that. Another ex-boyfriend, who it was nice to read that he was a little older than the rest at age 30, but was also an ex-con. Frank knew a lot of ex-cons. He also testified that when Frank caught him one day by playing cards with a woman, he got the Frank chases me with a sword trying to stab me to death treatment. A former cellmate of Frank's took the stand to swear that Frank had boasted about, quote, carving up the Kadunces, and said that he and Mike Atkinson had stabbed them to death, but he didn't know why he had done it. He also said that Frank had watched a show about child abuse with him on the TV in the rec room at the jail, and Frank had laughed at the accounts of children being burned with cigarettes. Okay, I'm not surprised by that at all. One of the more interesting witnesses for the prosecution was a woman named Jane, who was a follower of Frank's and had visited his apartment on the regular. She was also a self-proclaimed mystic, so I have to wonder if Frank resented the potential competition that she presented. She said that Ed Frank had offered to use astral projection to remove her husband from this life for only $25. That's really cheap. That is a bargain. She had also told the cops that she once called on Frank, who answered the door in his red panties and stockings, and introduced her to Lori, L-O-R-I, in quotes, his boyfriend, whom she said was a dead ringer for Lawrence Cadence. She also testified that when Frank was once hospitalized with chest pains, Lori visited Frank. Later on, she saw a photo of Larry Cadence and said, oh, that's him. That was Lori. And that's an odd nickname for him, right? I know that they're both L, but it's such a lady name, right? And I think he presented as a male exclusively, so interesting. She also told a story about how Frank took her to the local grave of 19th century local witch Mary Black, which was a favorite spot of his to hang out at besides the mall and his devil apartment. She also believed that Frank was clairvoyant because when he was in the hospital, he called her and he ordered her to bring him his Pall Malls. She said that she had no car available to bring the cigarettes to him, and Frank said that he knew that she was lying. She actually had three cars. And Jane was like, well, I guess his power is waning because I only have two cars in my driveway. And except later that day, her husband, dramatic music please, brought home a third car that he had bought that day. So Frank, obviously a psychic and can tell the future. It was a very silly story, but these people were full-on believers in Frank's mystical powers. And when she herself once had to check into the hospital, Frank came to visit her, and she was like, how'd you know I was sick? And he said, well, because your plastic bat fell from my ceiling, what a great warning system for when your followers are in need, right? Their plastic bat avatar falls from the ceiling. But the real nitty-gritty testimony from Jane was that she claimed that Frank had told her that he had shot Kathy Cadun, and that Kathy's husband Lou, who was also Frank's supposed boyfriend, and Mike Atkinson had been on the scene. And yes, there were multiple members of Frank's cult, his followers, who testified that Lou/Larry Cadence was an active member of the cult and a frequent visitor to Costell's apartment, as well as being Frank's lover, and that Frank was always demanding that Larry leave his wife Kathy for him. But the state's star witness against Frank was Mike Atkinson. He took the stand and told what was supposedly the actual true story of the murders. He said that he had met up with John Duo Dick, the D name, Larry Cadence, and Frank the night before the murders to discuss some drugs that Mike had paid Frank for that he hadn't received yet. That's when he learned that Kathy Cadence had supposedly flushed the drugs down the toilet because they were being held at Larry Cadence's house. What? These people are so strange. Anyway, so they decided the next morning they were going to have a discussion with Kathleen at the house. The four of them drove over, and Frank and Larry supposedly went upstairs and left Mike and John downstairs. And then Mike testified that he heard Kathy say something derogatory about homosexuals in relation to Frank and her husband. And then he also heard, and this is the part that breaks my heart, a little girl saying, I have to go to the bathroom. And then her dad, Larry, supposedly said, you have to wait. Sorry, you have to wait. All of a sudden, there was a shot. And when Mike went upstairs to see what happened, he noticed Kathy on the floor of the bathroom, Larry holding a gun, and Frank coming out of what turned out to be little Dawn's bedroom. And when he pushed Mike aside to go down the stairs, Mike testified that he left a bloody handprint on his shirt. The story was from Mike that Larry had killed his wife and that Frank had murdered Dawn and then come into the bathroom afterwards to stab Kathy 17 times because it was a ritual for him, and also because he finally would have his lover to himself. The prosecutor also called a local college professor to testify about the ins and outs of Satan worship, and he was very emphatic that the 17 stab wounds on both Kathy and Dawn were absolutely ritualistic and fulfilling a ritual for Frank. When Frank himself took the stand, it was a huge mistake on his lawyer's part. He was very soft-spoken and meek, and the very opposite of a psychic control demon teleporter curse master person. He tried to play off his occult beliefs, saying that it was just for fun. He did admit to knowing Atkinson for 5 or 6 years, but claimed they had only had sex once. And he said this by saying, "It was cold one night and I let him in." That's how most of my assignations have gone too. You just show up at the door in the winter. Frank then added that Mike had threatened him, saying, "I had the constant fear he'd make good on the threat. He was weird." Frank had no alibi, really. He just said that he was asleep the morning of the murders. He had difficulty remembering times and dates, and he denied that he even knew Larry Cadunce, let alone that Larry was his lover. He said he had absolutely no knowledge of the crime. The jury hated him. They had listened to all this testimony about what a freak he was, and also the prosecutor really doubled down on the Satan worship, on the blasphemy, and especially on the homosexuality, which really didn't fly with this conservative jury. In his closing argument, he made a huge deal about Frank's comments on Mary and Jesus being, you know, part of the gay community. I shouldn't laugh, I'm sorry. Almost as if that was as bad as the murder of a mother and her 4-year-old child. I mean, honestly, by the way, Frank was found guilty of after 3.5 hours. And after court that day, the DA told the press that anybody who holds the word of God in contempt is in for a lot of trouble. I mean, I know that Frank sucks and he absolutely should have been off the streets, but that guy sounds like a major douche. And Frank got a life sentence. The third trial in this story was Lou/Larry Cadunce's trial for the murder of his wife and daughter. And the cops really thought it was going to be an open and shut thing with the jury finding him guilty totally. But things didn't go that way. The jury seemed to like him. He was very different in appearance from Frank, and he seemed like way less of a scumbag than Mike. He also had a long line of normal-looking friends and neighbors coming in to testify on his behalf, to what a great guy he was and how much he loved Kathy and Don, how he would never hurt his family. Also, the star witness in this trial was again Mike Atkinson, but this time Larry's defense attorney tore him a new one and just completely flayed him alive on the stand. Cadunce's lawyer made the allegations that his client was gay and sold drugs with his alleged lover, Frank Costell. He made all of it sound ridiculous and like the lies of several crazy drug addicts. And Lawrence Cadunce was found not guilty of the murder of his wife and child. Frank Costell went home to Satan in 2001 while he was serving his life sentence in a care unit for geriatric prisoners. He was 71. Like I said before, Mike Atkinson died in prison too, and Larry Cadunce went on to live a full life. He eventually remarried and had more kids. I even found his obituary online, and he died this past September. And do you think it was COVID? Wouldn't that be crazy? He ended up with 14 grandchildren and 4 great-grandchildren. So if he was guilty, if he killed his wife and daughter for his male lover, he got away with it. I'm not sure what to believe. See, the thing is, there were so many different versions told by people about what actually happened in the house that we don't know what actually happened in the house. Mike's version differed from Frank's version. Larry said it never happened. A neighbor of the Cadunces said that she had seen whom she identified as Frank and Mike walking near her house shortly before the time of the murders. So it was sort of vague. She did testify, but it didn't really land well. So many versions. I don't know what to believe, really. Frank had sway over a lot of broken people. I mean, did he get them to lie for him about the alleged affair with Larry? Was that totally made up? And I don't trust that Mike guy as far as I could probably throw him, so I'm torn on this one. And I should point out that there was no physical evidence linking any of them to the crime scene besides Lawrence Cadunce, but he lived there, so just everybody testifying against each other. And that's the Devil Man story. Now it's time for Wicked Good Gay. Did you know that President Gerald Ford had 2 assassination attempts against him? He did. One of them was by Charles Manson's prize follower, Squeaky Frome, and that was prevented by a Secret Service person slapping the gun out of her hand. The second one was also by a woman. It was a housewife named Sarah Jane Moore, and she fired a pistol at Ford in San Francisco. But a decorated U.S. Marine and disabled Vietnam War veteran named Oliver Sipple grappled with her as she fired and caused her to miss. And he probably saved President Gerald Ford's life. And he was gay. Things didn't go so well for Oliver Sipple after he saved the president's life. Basically, he he got screwed for doing a good deed. After this happened, he was outed in the press by a San Francisco Chronicle columnist named Herb Kane, and also by Harvey Milk. Harvey thought that Oliver being gay and saving the president's life was a huge deal for the gay community. He was even quoted as saying that it's too good an opportunity. For once we can show that gays do heroic things and not just all that caca. He used the word caca. Oh, I hate that word. About molesting children hanging out in bathrooms. And he outed Sipple to portray him as a gay hero and to break the stereotype of homosexuals as being, quote, timid, weak, and unheroic. You know, I love you, Harvey, but that was a misstep. The only people who should be outed are people who try to introduce legislation against LGBTQ plus people and then go to the airport bathroom to shuffle ball change, if you know what I'm saying. In that case, have at it, boys. Those are the people you should be outing. Besides them, no. I can see the pull of it, but total misstep. There was also a lot of brouhaha from the gay community because Oliver was never invited to the White House like other heroes had been. And, you know, obviously it was because he was a homosexual. He later on did receive a note from Gerald Ford thanking him, a brief note, but wasn't a lot of like celebration over Oliver's good deed. And what sucked was being outed turned his family against him. Reportedly, his mother disowned him, and his mental and physical health sharply declined over the years. He drank heavily, eventually was diagnosed with schizophrenia. He was fitted with a pacemaker. He gained tons of weight. It brought him so much negative attention, he said, that he actually expressed regret about saving the president and grabbing Sarah Jane Moore's gun. And on February 2nd, 1989, an acquaintance found Sipple dead in his San Francisco apartment. That's a really sad story, but and sorry to bring it down, but Oliver Sipple was a hero. He saved the president, and he was gay, so that's your Wicked Good Gay for today. My sources for this episode were the Newcastle Cadunce Murders by Dale Richard Perelman, and a story at Medium.com called Gay Affair Ends in Satanic Murders by Lisa Marie Fuqua. That's a Gay Affair Ends in Satanic Murders. This was not a True Detective magazine. It was like I think Medium's like a legit site. Okay, Lisa Marie. Our theme song is You Won't Get Away with Murder by Gino and the Goons. You can find them on Spotify and at Facebook. Additional music by JB, cover art by Paul Chapman, and sound engineering by the other Mr. Harvey. For pictures of the dregs, or the main dreg involved in this tragic, brutal story, check out Wicked Gay Pod on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And you can write me at wickedgaypod@gmail.com. And there's one more episode left in season one, and then it's Christmas. And I will be taking a brief sabbatical while I plot and plan season two. You've been listening to Wicked Gay, a true crime podcast about gay people doing awful things.